The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network, Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network, of course. My guest today is John McMurtry. I'm delighted to have John back. John will share his thoughts on some of the major issues going on today. I always like to mention John's books because they're so important. They're ones that I've read, and I strongly recommend them. They include Unequal Freedoms, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, and Value Wars. I recommend everybody read those books to understand the situation that exists, that the problems that we face and have to cope with, and John explains them as well as anybody I know. Let me just make a few comments myself about what concerns me so much. So much concerns me all the time. But in recent days, recent weeks, I should say, I've written a good bit about the situation in the Middle East. It's not good, and it's getting worse. I guess Obama doesn't have enough wars on his hands. He continues the Bush war in Iraq, the so-called, I don't know what term he used to explain it, but the so-called exiting of U.S. troops. It wasn't an exit. There are still thousands there. Never discussed, but I've written a couple of times about it. The country is literally infested with what's called private military contractors. They include all types, from the Blackwater killer types, they're now called Academy. The name was so controversial they had to change it twice. DynCorp is another company doing the same thing. These are hired killers to practice their trade, what they know best. And even when there was a full contingent of U.S. forces in Iraq, and still in Afghanistan, there are more private military contractors in both countries than actual military troops. And that's still the case in Afghanistan. It most certainly is the case in Iraq. And there are still thousands of U.S. troops. What's going on in Iraq? The troops didn't leave. They were just repositioned nearby. And I, in an article I wrote yesterday, I mentioned a report from the Tribune Company, that includes my hometown Chicago Tribune, that very quietly America sent in 15,000 more U.S. forces. And I believe they're either in, I believe they are in Kuwait, and there are more coming as far as I know. And I put out a very brief article a day or two ago. I write so many, I forget which day different things went out. But in the last 24, 48 hours, I got a report that there are 12,000 U.S. forces in Malta positioned to be sent in as an occupying force. Where? In Libya. In Libya. There's ugly stuff going on in Libya. That's a separate story. But Obama's wars continue. He hasn't done enough. And now in the target zone are Syria and Iran. And the name of the game is regime change in both countries. Well, we say that the Syrian government is murdering their people. What isn't said is there is an externally generated insurgency that is murdering not only Syrian people, but Syrian security forces. At the same time, the Syrian government is absolutely authoritarian. They have a long way to go to be a responsible government. But compared to other rogue regimes in the region, they certainly are not the worst, far from it. The worst ones are America's closest allies, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Yemen, you know, these type countries where they literally go out in the street and they murder their people. Assad in Syria hasn't done that, but he certainly is fighting an externally generated insurgency that regional states in America, including Turkey and key NATO partners, are supporting. The big issue is Iran. I guess the strategy is first take down Syria, de-link it from Iran, leave Iran isolated in the region. We berate them for false charges, including supposedly wanting to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington. The charge was so ludicrous. What can I say about it? I wrote about it. Absolutely ludicrous. No credibility whatsoever. And then claiming Iran wants to develop nuclear weapons. Well, America comes up with an annual intelligence assessment. The latest one is in March 2011. It said, repeated the exact same language it used in 2010. In my words, there is no evidence whatever that says Iran has a nuclear weapons program underway. And there was a line thrown in saying, well, we don't know whether they have one. It's just that we can't find it. We can't find any. Well, Iran is infiltrated by U.S. spies, heavily monitored by satellite and other means. And this has been going on for years. And after all this going on, we can't come up with a crumb of evidence to prove that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And my goodness. America has one. Israel has one. Key NATO partners have them. India and Pakistan have them. Hear any complaining about them? Hear anybody asking for regime change in them? Oh, I think regime change in America and Israel and Britain and France, I absolutely endorse that, not by violence, but regime change would be wonderful in those countries. Well, Iran doesn't threaten anybody. It hasn't attacked another nation in, 200 or so years. Its neighbors don't fear Iran. They don't expect Iran to do anything nasty to them. Yet America uses this as a pretext to jump all over the country and say it is a regional threat. It's a threat to U.S. security. U.S. security? Iran is no way to harm America, even American forces in Iraq. My goodness. These charges are a complete red herring, but you've got to come up with something to justify wanting to target a country. And unfortunately, most people in America get their news from television. The one mainstream television, of course, the one place that absolutely never broadcasts news. Well, they broadcast what's called managed news, plus a lot of infotainment, but you certainly never learn anything by watching U.S. television. None of them, whether it's CBS, a Fox, a CNN, they are worthless. Well, everybody who listens to this program knows it. But too many people still follow them, and they believe the incessant, widely repeated propaganda, just proliferating these stories, inciting fear. But still, America needs a justification to attack. Well, who knows what and when, but the tried and true way after generating fear is something on the order of a false flag. Dare I suggest another Gulf of Tonkin? Well, that was minor compared to the last big one, and that was, well, I shouldn't say the last big one. We had 2003. We had WMDs that didn't exist in Iraq. We accused Gaddafi in Libya of all kinds of things that were either exaggerated or untrue. But the real big one that everyone knows is the 9/11 event, and that's the event that changed everything. Changed everything, and that ignited the war against Pakistan, against Afghanistan. Now it's called the AFPAC war. Unfortunately, Pakistan got dragged into this thing, literally threatened either join us as a partner or we'll bomb you to rubble. That's virtually what they were told. So they're still in it. It's been a very bad proposition for them. It's been a bad proposition throughout the region. America wants total unchallenged hegemony throughout the entire Mediterranean basin, across North Africa, the Middle East, into Central Asia, to Russia and China's borders, and the main targets down the road, absolutely without question, everything is an hors d'oeuvre compared to China, mainly economically, but China is no small fry military power, but it's mainly China's economic power, and Russia is the only military power that can really challenge America blow for blow. Doesn't have the exact same military strength, but it certainly has the nuclear arsenal and the sophisticated weapons, missile systems to send those weapons anywhere and probably in a 24-hour period annihilate America just the way America can annihilate at least most of Russia. Russia's a little bit bigger than America. Well, there's a picture of what concerns me, and I put out new articles in the past several days on targeting Syria and Iran. I worry that 2012 could be a decisive year, a greater Middle East war against both countries, and dare I say, they're developing into general war that has another very frightening name. Dare I call it World War III. Let's hope it doesn't happen, but the possibility is real. John, that was a little longer than I wanted to go on, but let me turn it over to you for your thoughts.
Well, there's nothing I disagree with there, Steve, except I wouldn't say that it was there were any separate stories involved. Every one of them, conforms to one ultimate, and that's what I'd like to get into. What is the ultimate rigidly deciding structure, inner logic of this whole process? And which also would, you said, well, it's regime change. Well, it's, again, it's much, I think, deeper than regime change. That's really more on the logic of pretext and what will be talked about in the mass media. But what's really going on here is you have really, and you're quite right about the 9/11 being the basis of the whole choice structure of American foreign policy and indeed NATO foreign policy led by the U.S. Ever since that has been, and we've talked about that enough, I won't go over the 9/11 itself other than, it's a fraudulent construction that has justified all this. And it really carried forth and made possible what people were increasingly recognizing as a big lie all over the place. It made possible the institution of that big lie. That, I think, is the ultimate importance of 9/11. And I think that we have really, and I've used the model of the explanatory model of cancer. The way the cancer invades, and, it works at the same level of social life reproduction, is that it's masked. What its invasion in the host life body or life host is always, it's not perceived by the immune system, and we might say everything that we have to do with real defense and real media discourse and so forth is really part of this immune system, recognizing what is actually harming the life host. And so I think that the key is that it only works, this whole monstrous construction only works any step of the way if it remains masked to the people. They're not going to let it go on, and they're not going to believe it in it and so forth. And of course, an enormous amount is spent on keeping that, sustaining that mask. And I think virtually everything you've just said in the introduction is really part of the masking process. So the key, it follows from that the key is to unmask it. And let us be clear on what the U.S. foreign policy is. We can talk good and bad, and I think it's evil by all objective criteria. But what they think from inside their system, is they have planners and deciders and strategic brainstormers that are working around the clock, and they're bright people, and I think I've mentioned this before, and they have one law, and this law runs of decision making and understanding, and this law runs right into the U.S. social sciences and now world social sciences, and indeed it runs right into philosophy itself, and it's called rationality. And rationality, for in accordance with this underlying presupposed law, is to strategically self-maximize your money value gains. That's it. Everything is about that. And so any way that you can do it is smart. any way you can do it is rational. And what, you know, and it basically means, you know, of course they never tell us this is what it means, even at the high theory level. It means everything for yourself, that's a given, that it's only atomic self-maximizers, and everything for the self, and nothing for life. There's never any life coordinate has anything to do with this whole process of decision making, and you externalize all life costs onto others. That's just built in as the meta program. And so then we know, okay, once we realize that's the frame from which they work, they are creatures of it, they cannot decide, you know, I spend a lot of my professional life exposing it and unmasking it because that is really, I think, the inner core of the whole process that has been accepted through presupposition. Once we unmask that, then we see, well, what are they going to go for in the Middle East? Well, it's clear enough. Everybody's getting this clear. But this isn't just something that, you know, comes up here and there as in Iraq or whatever. The strategic self-maximizing program is always for oil in the Middle East. That's, I mean, that's sort of self-evident. But it's not, seems to be never self-evident as we go through each one of them. You know, we've gone through recently Libya. They're doing it in Somalia right now. The same thing is being set up. We talked about that. All the disorder and the confusion in Somalia, it's a tumor in the cancer model. It's a huge tumor, and it's really all been constructed by the U.S. through proxies. Kenya's involved, Ethiopia's involved, and so forth. That's a long story in itself, which I think you're aware of. And then, of course, we had Iraq not so long ago, and it's still going on. And it's all about oil. It just sees weaker countries' oil bases. That's the self-maximizing interest. So know that's clear. The problem is it's never talked about. Every time we hear about Iran, all we hear about are these fraudulent stories about why Iran's a danger with their nuclear arms. We never really hear about the oil. They want Iran's oil, and they're going to get it if they can. Know that. And, of course, they can only do that if they can whip up the public into a frenzy over an enemy, because the U.S. whole entire foreign policy, whole ideology is based upon having an enemy. And the enemy is constructed, and the enemy is very important to have the audience automatically, like as an Orwellian two-minute hate, automatically start foaming at the mouth every time they hear this trigger word, Iran, or communism, or Soviet Union, or Islamic fanatics, or whatever the code word happens to be, and they just go in an Orwellian mass attack. And just for people to know, I mean, to realize, to remember that they've done this again and again, the biggest mystery to me is how the people don't catch on. Here we go again. I've talked to medical people a lot wondering, you know, how do you understand this medically, that they can just, the whole population can again and again, I shouldn't say the whole population, but a strategic threshold of them, believe these stories, and it's the same story ever and ever again. It's, well, there's a despot there. We don't like the despot. You don't like the despot. He's evil. Therefore, we must take him down, and we must have all the oil. I mean, as soon as they took Libya, you know, the stories were, the French and the British, let alone the Americans, were celebrating sending their businessmen there immediately. Even the U.S. foreign policy advocates and spokespeople were saying, well, it's the spoils of war. I mean, and yet that's all forgotten. We're not even talking. When I hear Iran, I don't hear about they're out to get their oil again. They're out to invent a story about weapons of mass destruction again. They're doing the whole same program again. They've done it again and again and again and again. The most dramatic since 9/11, when it started before 9/11, it was a crucial part of the whole strategic planning of it, was to get Iraq's oil. And then we went to Libya's oil. Now we're going to Iran's oil, and we're going for Somalia's oil that nobody even knows about. The big problem with here is nobody's really mentioning, but that really worries me. I have friends in Africa and so forth, and we all know that things are going on there with the Chinese buying up land and buying up oil reserves and so forth madly in Africa. And I'm afraid that the whole, that China, I watched with interest during those the broadcast of the UN Security Council meeting on whether they were going to attack Iran or not in the name of stopping, you know, a threat to humanity through weapons of mass destruction. And I watched with interest China's response. The China delegate, who was quite young, and I wondered, why are they sending such a young person who didn't say one word, and had, you know, I watched his facial expressions because it was on television, and I watched all the proceedings, and he never even gave an indication of disapproval of anything during the whole process. China is on side. And China is on side, not only because of all the, you know, they're funding the U.S. government and so forth, but China is on side because as the U.S. is banging the drum and invading Iraq and invading Libya and invading Somalia and taking it all, China's doing the same thing quietly, buying it up. They're not so dependent on military means. But they're buying up all the oil, and they're buying up all the markets and so forth in Africa, and I think there's an exchange, especially since I heard just yesterday that the new Prime Minister of Taiwan has made very friendly gestures towards China, and that, you know, that's an, you know, very, I thought to myself, well, that's, you know, that's a Clinton administration, you know, and foreign policy matter that's quite smart to get Taiwan to reconcile itself with China, and then you think a little deeper and you say, of course, that fits the whole pattern. China is being given a free hand everywhere else. And so, and then including, you know, with Taiwan. And so that's the deal, because, you know, the U.S. and China are on relatively different terms now, since, I don't need to explain that, everybody knows it. But now they're making a deal with China, and that's in the background. And that's the one that worries me most, is that they are going to have China on side for this, because they are going to invade Iran, and they're going to take their oil, because it fits the self-maximization program. It's just a given. That's what you do. It's oil and, you know, it's treasure. And, you know, you have the enemy. The thing is, the enemy's already constructed. It's very important to have the enemy constructed so you have the Orwellian reaction of just 2 minutes hate every time the term is mentioned. They've got that with Iran. They've managed to steer it up. And then, of course, the mass media are the ones who actually, you know, they're just part of the corporate structure that runs the U.S. government. It's exactly the same transnational corporate agencies that run the government as well as the media, and you know, they're all, it is a monopoly media, and they will do nothing else but validate this story. They won't tell about China, they won't tell about oil, they won't tell about anything. They'll just go on and on and on about it, how Iran is uncivilized, how Iran is terrible towards women, how Iran is ready to make a nuclear bomb. The problem is with the nuclear bomb thing is that, I mean, as you've already pointed out, and I won't go further into it, and you've written some great articles exposing, there's just no evidence whatsoever. There's even less evidence than they had for Saddam. It's almost laughable in a tragic humor way. How can they do this? Weapons of mass destruction, just substitute the word nuclear bomb and do the same thing over again to justify going in and taking their oil. I mean, it's just incredible that they can go on doing it. And the hypocrisy of it, the hypocrisy. Hypocrisy of it. To say, I mean, the only thing, if I were in Iran myself, and I've written the little notes to the media, and of course they'll never publish, but I must say, if it's irrational, it's certainly rational for Iran to have nuclear power and nuclear arms, because that's the only thing the U.S. and Israel won't attack. Is nuclear armed people. They will only attack weaker. They will only attack something that can't hurt back. They're structured as total bullies. Well, that's all, you know, that's smart politics. And they will not hit Iran if Iran has nuclear arms. So I think Iran should have nuclear arms in order to defend themselves against the mad dog system that's going to, you know, destroy their society too. But in fact, it seems that Iran doesn't want a nuclear bomb. I mean, it actually seems that, you know, and we again see the projection. The U.S. always projects onto the enemy what it's doing itself as its excuse for attacking it. Very interesting operation. They always project onto the enemy what they are doing themselves in spades as the reason for attacking the enemy. It's a really psychopathic operation that underlies and governs virtually everything the U.S. does in terms of, you know, when they start having an enemy. And they will do this on nuclear arms when they've got, you know, the stockpile of nuclear arms that are a danger to the whole of the world are just keep on going up. And but other countries that you're likely to attack have no, and who have no reason to attack you, never have any record of it. You have all sorts of record, the U.S. does, of attacking them, and Canada will be on side. And that they would have a nuclear arms, it seems perfectly sensible. But the total hypocrisy while you're building up saying, this is evil, they're lawless, they're breaking the international law. So not only do they falsify all the facts, but then they invoke international law, and there's one country who's a rogue state who obeys no international law, no international law on war crimes, no international law on crimes against peace and preparation for war. They just systematically violate it on every level. And then they invoke international law as the reason to attack Iran. I mean, if somebody wrote it, if Orwell had written it, I would say, well, it's quite a story, but it's implausible. How could people ever go along with it? And then you get into, well, what are the effects, which they never talk about? What the effects are always with them is they're omnidestructive. The U.S. military from the beginning is omni-life destructive. It's the biggest polluter in the world. It's it reuses the most. It's the biggest user of oil in the world, and therefore of carbon emissions, and you know all the byproducts of oil and machines. So it's the biggest polluter in the world, just as it stands. Let alone that once it goes into motion, it's eco-genocidal. And that's a term I've had to coin because there doesn't seem to be another word for what always happens. Not only do they destroy the society, but they destroy the conditions of life within which society lives, both natural and built. And Iraq is just such a perfect model of an eco-genocide. And what is the genocide? You might say, well, there's still Iraqi people living. I know there's 580,000 children have been killed deliberately, and that's all. You know, that was all deliberate defense intelligence, which is never quoted, you know, it deliberately caused all the diseases and so forth, which killed all those children. And then there's well over a million people altogether, you know, maybe it's 2 million. It's hard to keep track because that's one thing they never talk about. But what is the common quality? And I mentioned this before, every time they're going, and Iran is just the latest example. That's the thing. It's just a logical space inside the same story of evil over and over and over again with exactly the same parameters, and they just put another name into it. It's Iran instead of Iraq. And it's always societies that have social ownership of their primary resource, which in this case is the world's most valuable resource, oil. Always. That's who they're attacking, from Iraq to Libya to Somalia, to which we don't know about its oil, but there is, and obviously with Iran, is to get control of the oil, and that's also why they attacked Afghanistan, is to get control of the pipeline for oil to go east. I mean, it's a huge requirement for the oil. You know, if you're going to control the oil fields, you want to control the transportation of oil, and you've got to get it going east, and the only way you can do that is through going through Afghanistan. So all of them are over oil, not only oil, because they want their markets, they want their agriculture, they want everything, but oil is the big one. And which society they're always going to attack, and you can again predict it, will be one that has socially owned resources, especially socially owned oil. And that is the real reason why they always attack in all the cases I've just given. And they also have, worst of all, they have public control over private capital export and movement and commodities coming in from outside. They have public authority control over that. Now, those things are just anathema to this system, because it's ultimately a religious system of turning money into more money for private money possessors as God. Literally, you can substitute that formula. Every time they mention God, that's what they mean underneath the actual language. But you say, this is an impossible thing to do because we have a government, we have a society, the U.S., that is in an economic black hole. It's dragged the whole world into an economic black hole with its fraudulent financial doings, which is really the inner wheel of all wheels. And how can they spend more than the $2,000 million every day they're spending on the military, which they'll have to do if they invade Iraq or Iran? Notice that you can just slip easy from one to the other. And for most people, I suppose, they're just interchangeable. If we had that $2,000 million a day, imagine what we could do inside the United States to restore, to use economic terms, to restore the aggregate demand that's been hollowed out of the whole society by the normal things that have always worked in the past, which is to ensure that there's jobs, and you do that through public sector hiring to produce social goods,
for example, education.
We'll go on. I can hear
you. Yeah, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back. All those comments, very important. I agree with all of them. I'll make a quick comment or two when we come back, but let's take a short break. Welcome back on with John McMurtry. John, just a couple of quick comments. From some of the things that you mentioned, it really is amazing. No matter how often most people in the country are fooled to think a non-belligerent, non-threatening country actually is a great threat to America, and then they later find out that it was a big lie. It happens repeatedly, and the powers that be, there are new powers, so maybe at times some of the same ones, they can come back and pull the same stunt again, and most people, again, they're fooled. And when they finally wake up to the latest big lie, it's too late to matter. As far as China goes, John, I'm sure China wants no conflict with America. At some point, it may not be given a choice. One of the two regions of the world that America is targeting to build up militarily, the Middle East is the obvious one, and the other one is Asia-Pacific. And the reason is, well, you've got Russia, you've got Eastern Russia there, but the main rival is China. China is very upset about that. Oh, a comment, I forget the comment you made that made this thought pop into my mind, but a lot of code language is used. And in the America's Declaration of Independence, when Jefferson and whoever wrote it with him used the phrase our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, what they really meant was the pursuit of property, but they couldn't say that, so they substituted the word happiness for property, and code language is used all the time, and most people don't know the difference. They accept the words literally. And one more thing, your last comment before we went to break. You mentioned, imagine if we took this money that we spend on imperial wars and the gross buildup of the U.S. military spending more money now than the rest of the world combined. Imagine if we used even a small portion of this for homeland needs that are desperately needed. Well, I wrote an article today, John, that I'll probably get it out tomorrow. I'm ahead of myself by one or two. This one will probably go out tomorrow. But I wrote about the great divide in America between rich and poor. I mean, it is enormous. And there's one study after another. I found a whole bunch of them that document the incredible wealth disparity between the super rich and the next category would be just the ordinary rich, as opposed to the one-tenth of the top one-tenth of the 1%.
Yeah.
Then you'd go to the 1%, and then maybe the 5% or 10%. But you get down to the bottom 40% in one 50%. Of the studies that I saw. And these people either have zero net worth or they're underwater.
Yeah.
But the top 1%, well, a number that was quoted and one said they control 84% of the wealth in the country.
Yeah.
I think it's well over 90%. I mean, I think it's literally well over 90%. They certainly control the important assets, stocks, bonds, other securities. Ordinary people don't have that stuff. They've got dribbles here and there, but
just conned into using any savings they've got to put it in, so it too can be ripped off.
Exactly.
That's what's happening. Your kids aren't going to get a higher education unless you invest in it. Once you start investing in it, well, that's another site, because it is like a cancer. It'll move into any opportunistically into any site and seize it. So then they'll seize the money that the poor people, not part of the 1%, can't afford to lose, but that's the only way they can be sure of an education. Even more so, the only way you can be sure of old age pension, which is all being, you're forced into, and our government too has done this. You're forced into buying in stocks and so forth. I mean, I'm not in my own program, because that's very, you're elite and lucky in the sense that it's a university program. But the most people are being forced into the stock market, and then what little money they have to spare, probably it's money that they've borrowed, they've gone into debt to get, because it's the only way they can get a pension. So not only is the 1% taking this, and it's an exponentially increasing share. Like, they just are going up and up and up and up. It's multiplied itself since 1970. It's incredible. Not only are they doing that, but they're taking more, finding more ways of ripping off the people of what they don't have. And the key one of doing it isn't just through education and through pensions most of all, but of course through this whole social program system. Any social program is being privatized or defunded and so on while the war machine's going on. And they're taking it away, that away too. So, that's why I keep coming back. And as I mentioned to you, I'm doing the second edition of The Cancer Stage of Capitalism and writing a very long introduction trying to frame all of this. And what you see as you do this is just how much it behaves like a cancer. It just spreads and moves and opportunistically raids every vulnerable spot, every spot that there's immunosuppression, to use the language of at the cellular level, anywhere there's immunosuppression, which is all the areas that we've been talking about, where the people don't know what's going on and don't have any way to defend themselves, that's where they move next, to make it even more extreme. And what occurs to me right now is I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the Republican debate, because I was just hearing from my brother, who's a physician, and also was a deputy minister of health for Canada. He was saying that it was quite interesting just before this program, he was saying it's quite interesting what's going on in the Republican race, because Newt Gingrich being behind, having, lost to the money attack ads, and of course one isn't unhappy to see Newt Gingrich losing, but he's taken off the gloves and gone after Romney for being a vulture capitalist. And Romney says, well, that's capitalism, the story, as I understand it, was that Romney invested $30 million in a company, extracted $180 million by firing all its people and selling off its assets and basically liquidating it, and he made $180 million, that is 600% on the deal. And for him, that's capitalism. As I say, rationality, just multiply the amount of money you got, and the faster you can multiply it, the better it is. But that's the behavior of the cancer. The key to a cancer is a self-multiplying cell with no committed function to the life host. That's what Romney himself is doing, and he could be the next president of the United States. But it's funny that it's being exposed. I didn't know that about Romney until Gingrich brought it out. There's a problem with the whole ideological system now as well. Nobody really can believe in it anymore. It's such a big and obscene lie that's just raking people down. And then you hear this, that it's, you wonder what they've got left to hold, what they've got left to present to people as somehow better. What do you think about these disclosures that are coming out of the Republican camp itself, which are kind of unusual? Do you think there's any hope in there?
Well, I honestly believe that Obama will be reelected unless there's something awful that happens between now and November. I think the script has been written, John, that Obama will be reelected. I mean, the bankers absolutely love him. He's given them more than any president ever gave them in history. I think all of them rolled up together. So I think they want to keep him. As far as Romney goes, I decided I wanted to write something about him. I wrote about Michelle Bachmann. She dropped out. I wrote about Rick Perry, and he's so weak that I expect him to drop out. And Romney, it's really Romney and Ron Paul, and I think the deal is rigged to be sure that Ron Paul doesn't get it, because he's got these wild ideas in their mind that the Federal Reserve is predatory and we need to get rid of it. My goodness, talk about heresy. That's really going after the heart of the money system. So they want to beat up on Ron Paul. But you're right.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're
Romney,
right. Those are better disclosures.
Oh, yeah. Romney is no dope. I discovered that he was one of the rare graduates of a program combining the Harvard Law and Business Schools, John, and he graduated from Harvard Law School with honors, and he was in the top 5% of his class, a Baker Scholar at the Harvard Business School.
Yeah.
So this guy is more dangerous than I thought. He's got a brain.
Yeah.
but he joined a consulting firm after he finished up his education, and then he joined another one that was called Bain and Company, and then in the 1980s it became Bain Capital, and this is the vulture capitalism firm, the vulture capital firm that he became the head of. And you're right, they attacked companies, weak companies, buying them in bankruptcy for a song, and then firing all the workers, restructuring, the usual kinds of things that they do, close plants. I don't know all the shenanigans that they pull, but they basically restructure it, make the credit holders take a major haircut, the stockholders lose everything, and then they end up selling it for 100 times or 200 times what they paid for it. And one of the companies that I discovered was one called American Pad and Paper, AMPAD. And they bought it for $5 million and sold it for $100 million a few years later. And I've got the details of the story in front of me. I'll use that as an example in my article. But this is what vulture capitalism is.
Yeah.
Just screw the workers and make millions of dollars.
And it isn't just that. You know, they're buying up all the chits of the bankrupt, least developed countries, who have been given given breaks on how much money they owe to the northern banks, and now the vulture capital is going after them, saying, well, no, you owe all this money, and they're going after places like Congo, where they think they've got assets that they can get, and so they buy it up at 1 cent on the dollar, and they're going after them. So it's not just happening on the level of corporations, it's happening on a bigger level, vulture capital. They're trying to do it in Iceland, too, by the way, is they're going after governments. And going and suing them through American courts, and succeeding in getting more money out of governments, because governments have more money to spend than people. So it's really, really vicious. I mean, you mentioned something, but it's all, you know, it goes way back to the Constitution when they said freedom, life, liberty, and happiness. They really just meant property. And you're right, but I want to go further than that and say it's worse than that. It doesn't just mean private property when most of the people are without private property at that time, and, you know, a large portion of the population enslaved, including Jefferson with lots of slaves, and who says, you know, all are born free and equal. I mean, the hypocrisy seems to almost to go with the gene of the U.S. nation. But you go back to Locke on property. Locke originally justified property. This was the justification that won the day. He wrote the treatise, Second Treatise on Government, which a lot of its language is right inside the Declaration of Independence, and the American Constitution, also the French Constitution, because these were bourgeois revolutions. And what Locke started out with was that private for what was the biggest turn in history, from transmission of wealth by bloodline to transmission of wealth by private property that's earned inside one's own lifetime or taken inside one's own lifetime. And so he said, well, the property, and these were very, and I remember as an undergraduate thinking, this is really very reasonable. He says if the justification for property is that you've mixed your labor with it. You don't have any justification for property if you haven't mixed your labor with it. And not only must you mix your labor with it, there must be enough and as good, and these are his words, enough and good enough left, as good enough left over for others to also do the same. So there must be not only you must mix your labor, but you must also, there must also be enough left over for others. And number three, he says there can't be any waste of the property. Because your justification for private property ceases, and you think, well, those are three good arguments for private property as opposed to, you know, the Lord through his inherited bloodline being able to take it from you, and that's its legitimacy, or the state, etc. But you know what he does in a single line, not even in a sentence, but within a phrase, within a sentence that's 50 words long, he says, until men by their consent gave value to money. And then, so private property then converted to money property in a single phrase. And then money, well, money can't spoil. Money can't be wasted. There's always lots of money around. You know, if people earn it, they're, or whatever. So all the other justifications, and you know, it replaces mixing your labor with it, the crucial thing. And just with a trick, like it's, the whole system is based on an ultimate shell game right from the beginning, right from the beginning. And the shell game is private property, that makes all sense because you have these three provisos, as they're called. It's converted into money property, which requires no labor, which has no conditions on it, and you can have it without limit. And that just happens, and you know, the scholars, and the Locke has been written on endlessly, never really identify this incredible shell game that's going on at the very heart of the discourse. So I think it's better, instead of saying it's for property, it's for money possession. It's all for money possession and more money possession without limit and without, you know, any requirement of anybody else having any. That is built right into the genotype of the system. And what we're seeing is the elaboration through hundreds of years of how evil that can become. I mean, we had, you know, during the Second World War and after the Second World War in particular, well, first of all, we had a mass workers' movement with unions and so forth, putting some limit on that through simple political power. And then we had the post-war where we had actual governments getting into what they should have been into all along, which is protecting the common life interests through programs like income security and pensions and unemployment insurance and health care and so forth, all the things that government should have been doing all along. And all of that, the key is that all of that, the unions and that, have been wiped out. And Obama's been a very key part of it while saying he was going to stop it. He's been a key part of wiping both those things out, which set any limit on to basically money sequence possession without limit at anybody's cost, and including, you know, the whole of the planet being an area for exploitation, and just target it and take it in order to turn it into more money for yourself. Well, since that has no life requirements being met whatsoever by it, it then becomes cancer-like. So it's not just property, it's money sequencing.
Well, money is always at the heart of it all.
Sequencing, you know, it's not just the money or the money accumulation. It's the sequencing into more money for possessors without end, never stopping.
Oh, exactly, that's, John. The phrase I like to use is money in private hands to make more of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the more they have,
it's always in motion. That's the thing. It's not an accumulation. It's always in motion to turn itself into more now in the nanosecond. And now clipping at the, you know, exploiting margins at exponential rates in a nanosecond time. That's how the big money is being made these days. And that's why only I think the notion of a private money sequence, where it turns into more exponentially more, and it seeks to maximize itself exponentially with no limit, no commitment to the host, no work, no nothing. And all of that has been allowed, and especially with the technological revolution, not only do you get the unions out of there, not only do you get government out of there, governments have just become their hirelings, now have it being able to move with volumes and velocities, infinite volumes and velocities in nanoseconds, and exploiting in an exponential multiplier on a margin of 0.01%, it multiplied enough times can make you $1 billion in a day.
Oh, exactly.
So you
Johnny.
Have the technology of it too, and then you have the deregulation that permitted it, so-called financial innovation, and you've just constructed a world cancer system.
Well, you give them $1 billion, they can leverage it 100 to 1, so they get 100 billion, and they can manipulate that and eventually turn it into trillions of dollars.
Well, that's why we've long gone on in this program about, you know, public banking, not only for the individuals in the society, but for governments themselves, that governments lend through a central bank to themselves, puts a stop to that. And then, because they're making most of their money out of governments and individuals who require money, and then they can use their multipliers by exploiting them. So you take away the exploitation site from them by capturing the money system back for the public. We've talked about that a lot.
Well, that is absolutely what you want and what I want. And there's even one of the Occupy Wall Street movements in San Francisco that one of its planks is they want a community bank set up, meaning a public bank. And, use the term public, they use the term community bank, I think, but I mentioned it in one article, and Ellen Brown wrote an entire article just on that topic. And, they're catching on.
And they're also transferring, Steve, an important thing, their money, a lot of money, hundreds of billions of dollars are changing out of private banks into credit systems.
Oh, indeed so. Indeed so.
Credit unions, yeah.
Trends can begin in small ways, and if enough people begin catching on and get angry, there's no question there's a lot of anger against the bankers, against Wall Street, against the big corporate interests, and if people start doing this stuff, a little bit can become a lot, it could become a trend, more people can join it, and the way to beat them is just don't be part of this system, form an alternate system, that's the way to do it, and it's what I like to say about the major media, John. There's one way to defeat them, the corporate media, that they have no defense against, and I'm thinking mainly of television. Tune them out.
Yeah, well, you know,
tune them
Steve,
out.
I don't give them 1 cent. Not for their press media, and not for their television media. Not 1 cent. I don't. And boy, are you a lot better informed and free? I think I may have mentioned this before. I haven't had television for years of my life, and it really releases you from basically a very toxic invader of your home, and both the newspapers, which are tree skins littered all over the place and are just like advertising flyers, basically that's their nature. Yes, you're right, that we tune out. One just wonders whether they're the tuning out of the corporate. So you tune out of all their money sequences. They're turning money into more money through you paying for a paper and paying and the advertising paying for you to read the paper. And so that stops the money sequence in its tracks at the individual level. And there's a lot the individuals can do. And this interesting thing, the banks aren't doing well. They're not doing well in Britain. They're not doing well in the States. They just basically got all this money and are sitting on it. They got from the public and are sitting on it and not lending it out because things are really in a state of a flood. They really don't know where to go to next. We really are at a stage where things could shift, and this election that's coming up, is it just going to be phony, baloney all the way, or are people actually going to do something?
Well, I think in America, I can't speak for other countries, but in America, John, and we're just about at the end of the program, I truly believe the system is rigged. I mean, if in 2000 the Supreme Court could elect the president against the will of the U.S. voters, both the popular vote and, as we learned later, the electoral vote as well when it was too late to matter, if they can simply annul the vote, and of course we have corporate-run electronic voting machines voting for people rather than individuals.
Which have already been used to.
Many people are excluded from voting. In some states, if you have a criminal record for stealing a stick of chewing gum, you lose your voting rights. I mean, this stuff is crazy. And, I mean, people are obstructed. But the whole system is manipulated. I don't trust it. And supposedly there are two parties. Well, it's really one party. It's a duopoly.
Yeah.
They don't disagree on the major issues. Unless people vote independent, don't vote. But if you use an electronic voting machine, who knows where your vote ends up? So, I mean, the script is probably written for November, but we need another way. We need an entirely other way. John, all I can say at the end of the program is, let's pick this up again next month because the story is going to go on.
Yeah.
And I only wish it could get better, but I fear in the months ahead it's going to get worse.
Yes, I can understand that.
John, many thanks. Many thanks. They're going to cut me off.
Yeah.
I'll just remind listeners that, of course, we're on every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern, and on weekends, Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Make it a regular habit.